From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we look at the far-reaching impact of federal housing policies that encouraged and caused segregation in communities throughout the United States.
African-American incomes, on average, are about 60% of white incomes, but average African-American wealth is 10% of white wealth. And that entire disparity is entirely attributable to unconstitutional federal housing policy.
Then we meet Marquette grad Brian Kastner, who canoed 1,200 miles through the Canadian wilderness during the summer of 2016.
It was a very different experience dealing with the bugs and the lightning and the wind and where are we going to put our tent tonight. And, you know, it's not a park. There's no designated campsite. So sometimes when you were stuck in a swamp, there's just nowhere to stop. You really start to appreciate wilderness in a different way.
Plus, we'll have the latest in our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first.
Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. While Milwaukee is often cited as the most segregated metropolitan area in the United States, it's hardly unusual. In most American cities, people of different races live in different neighborhoods. And there's a general pattern. Neighborhoods near the center of a city are home to African Americans and people of color, while the surrounding suburbs are majority white. But why?
That question is at the heart of Richard Rothstein's new book called The Color of Law. It explores the various avenues that federal, state, and municipal government agencies use to create a system of segregation throughout the U.S.
Rothstein was in Milwaukee earlier this week to deliver the keynote speech at the 10-year anniversary celebration for Community Advocates Public Policy Institute. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers ahead of that event, and their conversation begins with an explanation of de facto and de jure segregation.
De facto segregation is segregation that was created by private activity, by personal prejudice, either of homeowners, perhaps, who wouldn't sell to opposite race neighbors, or real estate agents who steered families to same race neighborhoods, or people's choices about wanting to live with others of the same race, or maybe because African Americans typically have incomes that on average are lower than white incomes and can't easily afford to move to more middle class communities. All of these individual actions and decisions in which government is not involved comprise de facto segregation, and the government is not permitted, according to the Supreme Court, to remedy de facto segregation, because if something happened by personal choice, it can only be undone by personal choice. On the other hand, de jure segregation is segregation that was created, enforced, maintained by government policy, law, regulation. And in that case, we are obligated to reverse it, to remedy it, because it's a constitutional violation. We have a national myth that, unlike other forms of segregation, as in the 20th century, schools were segregated, or lunch counters, or buses were segregated, or interstate transportation was segregated. Unlike all these other forms of segregation, when it comes to residential segregation, we believe that the government had nothing to do with it. It was all private choice. It's de facto segregation. And therefore, we're not permitted to do anything about it. The reality is that residential segregation in every metropolitan area in this country was explicitly created by federal, state, and local policies that were designed on their face to ensure that African Americans and whites could not live with one another. And because we don't recognize this history, we don't recognize our constitutional obligation to remedy it. If we understood the history, we would have to begin taking the kinds of policy steps that were necessary to desegregate metropolitan areas.
Now, your book, The Color of Law, is really the case for why we do have this responsibility. And you start with a look at San Francisco, specifically the Richmond, California area. What happened there, and why is it kind of a case that extends beyond Richmond specifically?
Well, I focus in the book on places like Richmond, which is in the San Francisco Bay Area, or Cambridge, Massachusetts, because they're thought of as being liberal areas. And I think that if I can explain to people that the government followed policies of explicit segregation in these areas, they may be able to better appreciate that it was done everywhere. In Richmond, there were very few African Americans living in that community before World War II, But during World War II, the defense industry created five shipyards in Richmond. It's a deep water port on the San Francisco Bay, just north of Berkeley. By the end of the war, there were 100,000 workers working in these shipyards. If you consider their spouses and the families, probably 400,000 people came to this small town of 20,000 during the war. If the government wanted the shipyards to continue to be built, it had to create housing for this influx of workers. And it created segregated public housing, creating a segregated pattern in the San Francisco Bay Area that hadn't previously existed. It built shoddy housing for workers along the railroad tracks and near the industrial area if they were black. It was shoddy, temporary, because the city of Richmond announced that any African Americans who came to the city during World War II would have to leave at the end of the war. And it built more stable housing for white workers in the shipyards in the more residential areas where white families were living further inland. I also talk about another defense facility in Richmond, a Ford motor plant that was converted to defense production during the war. It had been making automobiles during the war. It made tanks and jeeps. At the end of the war, it was converted back to civilian production. And about 10 years later, in the mid-1950s, as happened with so many industrial plants, Ford decided to close the plant and move it to a rural area in what's now Silicon Valley, about 50 miles south of Richmond. The United Auto Workers, the union, negotiated an agreement with Ford that all of the workers who worked at the Ford plant in Richmond could transfer to the new plant in Silicon Valley. The problem was that the white workers could easily transfer. The black workers couldn't because the federal government had another policy of creating suburbs for white workers only around major cities from which African Americans were explicitly excluded. And so there were houses being built in the rural area where the Ford plant and other industrial facilities were being built at that time, but the housing was for white workers only by requirement of the Federal Housing Administration. And as a result, black workers had great difficulty in moving there. The white workers who were able to buy homes in suburbs like those created in Silicon Valley in the mid-1950s bought those homes. They were very inexpensive. They cost about $100,000 in today's money. Today, those homes sell for $400,000, $500,000. They're all over the country, some places more, some places less. The white families who bought those homes in the area where the Ford plant relocated gained over the next couple of generations hundreds of thousands of dollars in wealth, in equity, from the appreciation of their homes. African Americans who were prohibited by federal policy from moving into single-family homes in the suburbs but gained none of that wealth. They continued renting homes, renting apartments in urban areas. The result of that policy is that today, African American incomes on average are about 60% of white incomes. But average African-American wealth is 10% of white wealth. And that entire disparity between a 60% income ratio and a 10% wealth ratio is entirely attributable to unconstitutional federal housing policy that was practiced in the mid-20th century. These two policies, the policies of the federal government to create housing, public housing, for working class families on a segregated basis, frequently segregating neighborhoods that hadn't previously been segregated, and the FHA's policy of creating all white suburbs for returning war veterans and for other working class white families from which African Americans were excluded. These two policies created the segregation that we have in every metropolitan area in this country, in some cases reinforced incipient segregation, but nowhere near as powerful what was created by these federal policies. And because of this enormous wealth gap that the policies created, they determine the racial landscape of our metropolitan areas still today.
Now, you just mentioned the FHA. I'm, of course, speaking with you from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which by some estimates is considered the most segregated metropolitan area in the United States. I think a lot of folks here especially are familiar with the practice of redlining, but I was personally less familiar with how involved the Federal Housing Administration was with ensuring that suburbs, neighborhoods remained segregated. How did the FHA work to maintain and cause segregated neighborhoods?
Well, in many cases, it caused segregated neighborhoods. Redlining refers to the Federal Housing Administration's policy of refusing to insure mortgages in African-American neighborhoods, forcing people who lived in those neighborhoods to buy homes on contract, as on the installment plan, where they gain no equity, or simply to rent or to double up in order to maintain housing costs. That's redlining. But the Federal Housing Administration had a much more powerful policy, which was to create single-family home suburbs, giant suburbs, around every metropolitan area in the country. The most famous of these was east of New York City in Levittown. Levitt, the builder, could never have assembled the capital to build 17,000 homes in one place. The only way he could assemble that capital was by going to the Federal Housing Administration, getting approval for his development on condition that he sold no homes to African Americans. The Federal Housing Administration even required Levitt to place a clause in the deed of every home in Levittown prohibiting a resale to African Americans or rental to African Americans. As a result, he was able to take this FHA approval to banks and get guaranteed insured bank loans to build the subdivision. And this went on all over the country in the Milwaukee suburbs, as well as in every metropolitan area. The most well-known symbol of suburbanization in the 1950s was Los Angeles. Many suburbs around Los Angeles were created in this way on a white-only basis by the federal government. This was an explicit federal policy to create segregated metropolitan areas. It combined a refusal to support housing for African Americans in predominantly African American neighborhoods and a refusal to permit African Americans to move to single family homes in all white suburbs. The subsidy for white families in this period of American history was so enormous that white families could move out of public housing, which they were paying the full cost in rent in urban areas, and with an FHA or a Veterans Administration mortgage, could pay less in their monthly housing costs in single-family homes in the suburbs than they were paying for rent in public housing.
One of the more eye-opening things for me in this book was really that public housing was initially intended for middle-class white families in a lot of situations. How did public housing become something of and for the white middle class and move to what it is now and what we look at it as now?
You're absolutely right. That is how public housing began. The first public housing in this country was created during the New Deal in the Roosevelt administration. It was primarily for white working class families, middle class families. They paid the full cost of the housing and their rent. Separate projects were built for African Americans in cities all over the country, creating segregation where it hadn't previously existed. The great African American novelist, poet, playwright Langston Hughes describes how he grew up in a Cleveland neighborhood that was integrated in the early 20th century. Many urban neighborhoods were integrated at that time simply because working people didn't have automobiles to get to work, and most industry was concentrated downtown. And so they had to live in neighborhoods near downtown where they could walk to work or take short streetcar rides. So Langston Hughes grew up in such an integrated neighborhood in Cleveland. He says he dated a Jewish girl in high school. His best friend was Polish. This was typical around the country, integrated neighborhoods like that. The Public Works Administration demolished integrated housing in that Cleveland neighborhood and created two separate projects, one for African Americans, one for whites, creating a pattern of segregation in Cleveland that otherwise would never have existed in the strength that it does. In Cambridge, Massachusetts, the area near the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, the Central Square neighborhood was also a half-black, half-white neighborhood in the 1930s. The federal government demolished housing in that integrated neighborhood to create two separate public projects, one for whites, one for African Americans, creating a pattern of segregation in the Boston metropolitan area that otherwise never would have existed. Well, those projects on a segregated basis continued until the 1950s, when the Federal Housing Administration embarked on the program I mentioned before to move white families out of urban areas, out of public housing, and into single-family homes in the suburbs. Once that happened, large numbers of vacancies developed in public housing projects for whites. There were long waiting lists in the public housing projects for African Americans. Soon, the situation became so conspicuous that the federal government and local housing agencies had to open up the white projects to African Americans. At about the same time, industry left the cities, as in the case of the Ford plant that left Richmond and moved to rural areas. There were fewer and fewer jobs available, The African Americans, who are now almost exclusively living in public housing, became poorer and poorer. Eventually, public housing authorities had to subsidize the rents of families in public housing, and they became the kind of vertical, low-income, concentrated slums that we're familiar with today. Once the rents were no longer sufficient to cover the cost of public housing, maintenance declined on the projects, the government ceased making repairs, and they deteriorated, becoming, as I say, the caricature of what we think of as public housing today.
Your book gets into so very many things. It's hard to kind of encapsulate it in a fairly short conversation. But I would like to move to really the final chapter, which looks at a variety of solutions. Do you think there are politically viable solutions at this time, ways of creating more integrated neighborhoods?
Oh, yes, there are many, many more practical solutions. For example, many suburbs now maintain exclusionary zoning ordinances, ordinances that prohibit the construction of townhouses or single-family homes, even on small lot sizes, or apartments, low-rise apartment buildings that maintain their exclusivity. Those zoning ordinances should be prohibited. They were created in large part to preserve a racial exclusivity that was government created. So the zoning ordinances have an unconstitutional origin. We should require every suburb to permit its fair share of moderate income housing, of market rate housing, of housing for lower income families to create an integrated metropolitan area. We also have two policies for low income families today that reinforce segregation. One of them is the Section 8 voucher program, the Housing Choice Voucher Program, which subsidizes the rents of eligible families, low-income families. That program reinforces segregation because a family with a Section 8 voucher is more likely to live in a low-income segregated neighborhood than an equally low-income family without a voucher, and that's because of the program design. It's also because there are few apartments in middle-class areas where the voucher is large enough to rent apartments. So that program needs to be redesigned so that it promotes integration rather than segregation. The other program that we operate is something called the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit. It comes out of the Department of the Treasury. It's a subsidy to builders of low-income housing, and that subsidy also reinforces segregation because builders of low-income housing place it almost entirely in already segregated low-income neighborhoods. They do it because frequently land is cheaper there, most importantly because they don't have to hold a lot of community meetings, face opposition for placing subsidized housing in middle-class communities. But that program could easily be redesigned to place a priority on integration rather than on segregation.
Well, Richard, thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with me. And I hope you have a good time here in Milwaukee and have a great talk.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
Richard Rothstein is the author of The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. He's also a distinguished fellow of the Economic Policy Institute and emeritus senior fellow of the Thurgood Marshall Institute at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and a senior fellow at the Haas Institute at the University of California, Berkeley.
Rothstein spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers ahead of an event earlier this week that celebrated the 10-year anniversary of the Milwaukee-based Community Advocates Public Policy Institute. There's more information about his work at WUWM.com.
A quick break now, and then when we return, we'll be joined by Marquette graduate Brian Kastner to talk about his journey through 1,200 miles of Canadian wilderness. That's when Lake Effect Weekend returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee's NPR, WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyson.
And I'm Bonnie North. Brian Kastner is no stranger to difficult circumstances. The Marquette grad and former Air Force officer received a Bronze Star for his bomb disposal work in Iraq. As a journalist, he received grants to cover the Ebola outbreak in Liberia. And in 2016, he recreated the 1,200-mile canoe journey of 18th-century Scottish explorer Alexander Mackenzie. Mackenzie was trying to find the Northwest Shipping Passage through the Canadian wilderness to China.
Kastner's newest book, Disappointment River, chronicles both his own 40-day journey to the Arctic Sea and and Mackenzie's much longer trip. Kastner uses Mackenzie's own writings as well as other historical records to set the scene for Mackenzie's journey and to describe his disappointment at not finding the shipping lanes he wanted to.
Brian Kastner was back in Milwaukee recently just as Disappointment River was published. He stopped by the studio then to tell us why Mackenzie's story intrigued him so much that he wanted to recreate that epic journey.
I was in the military, I'm a veteran, and most of my writing up till now, my two books, Long Walk and All the Ways We Kill and Die, are both about Iraq and Afghanistan and the wars there. And all my journalism has been about the wars, and I was always focused on bombs and conflict. And when I was getting ready to take on a new book project, I knew I wanted to write about something different. And so I turned it around and I said, well, what are the books I most like to read? And it's this kind of thing, unexpected history, history that you thought you knew and it turned out that you didn't really understand it, and then also travelogue, going on an adventure. And so I was looking for a project where it was both something that I didn't understand and I could actually go out and do something about it. That's what I've learned as a journalist and as a writer, is I'm best when I'm going out and finding that story and then bringing it back. And with Alexander Mackenzie, I found him through a Google search accidentally. I happened upon this guy and I said, I couldn't believe that I didn't already know this. My fourth grade teacher lied to me. You know, Lewis and Clark were not the first Europeans across the continent. It was this other guy I had never heard of, and his expeditions were absolutely epic. And I had a chance to follow along and canoe in his path.
And I didn't know about him either. And I felt the same way as I was reading the book, thinking, wait a minute, my history that I learned when I was in school, it's like we all learned about Lewis and Clark, and maybe it's the lower 48 that they traversed first. But he was up in Canada, into the Northwest Territories, searching for that elusive Northwest Passage.
That's right. And at the time, I should say, I mean, I don't think there's any reason why the Canadians should claim him more than Americans. When he was doing these explorations, it wasn't Canada and it wasn't the United States. It wasn't anything, actually. It was territory that had competing claims, and it was not yet decided what country any of that land would end up in. And in fact, Mackenzie, he first landed in North America in New York City in 1775 in the middle of the American Revolution. And his first posting as a fur trader was in Detroit. So he certainly has plenty of American connections. And then his history is really the history of the continent. Sure, you know, he ended up taking this river that goes through what's now the Northwest Territories, and it hits the Arctic. That's the Mackenzie River. That river basin is the second longest in North America. It's almost like hiding in plain sight. But he was looking for the Northwest Passage, and who knows how history could have been different if people had followed him the way that the Oregon Trail followed Lewis and Clark. That's really why they're famous, is because it was a story of the settlement of the West. And if Alexander Mackenzie had found the Pacific at the end of that river, if he had not found pack ice, then who knows? There could have been a Mackenzie Trail of settlers, and the history of the continent could have turned out way differently.
Yeah, it's interesting because, of course, in the history, you've divided the book up in your own travelogue part, kind of mirroring what was happening with Mackenzie as he was doing his various explorations. And I had forgotten, even though I kind of knew this, I had forgotten how important the fur trade was to the New World. And I put quotes around the New
Right.
World, new to Europe. And the fact that people were making fortunes on exploiting the wildlife and exploiting the people that were already here through the fur trade. And so you've got, you know, the French, you've got the English, Scots in the case of Mackenzie, and then you've got the various tribes, the indigenous people who are already here, who were both either trying to keep people out or throwing their lot in with the Europeans because they saw it as inevitable. And I think you forget, or at least I did, that that was going on at that particular time, that there was this huge economic driver.
Right. I mean, in the 13 colonies, the primary wealth lay in arable land and turning Virginia and Pennsylvania and New York into farms. But once you get north of New York and it's nothing but impenetrable forest and snow, then the primary commodity, the primary wealth lay in furs. And it just so happened that you have all of this forest and all of this snow, which is perfect for, you know, growing things like beaver, that in the snow at the height of winter is when they have the most luxurious furs. And so you have a place where the beaver are plentiful, and it's also the place where there's all these rivers like the St. Lawrence, like the Winnipeg, like the Great Lakes, all these bodies of water that cut through the continent. And so they would never have been able to get through all of that land if there were not these rivers. The forest would have been in the snow and everything else would have stopped them. But you had this confluence of factors where, yes, they could, they being the voyagers, mostly French paddlers with English or American or Scottish bourgeois, they called them, is what the French called them, you know, these agents who did all the buying and selling. And, you know, the indigenous nations there being able to produce these furs, that's how they got cloth and they got flour and they got weapons and gunpowder and shot and rum and all of these things. It was a mutual economic advantage. And really, it's a story of partnership. I talked to a Canadian historian. I thought this was fascinating. And he said, down south, you guys talk about cowboys and Indians and everybody shooting at each other. And up north, we talk about cowboys with Indians because it was always a partnership. And there were very few white people and the indigenous nations were really in charge of, you know, it was their economic system, and there was a lot of mutual benefit. Of course, you know, some tribes prospered and some declined, and it was usually who had access to guns and, you know, the spread of smallpox. It's not purely a positive story, but is much more mutual than oppressive.
Although your experience going through these territories and eventually getting to, I guess, is it technically the Pacific you got to, or is it the Arctic?
It is the Arctic. You know, the Rocky Mountains are in the way.
That's so true. Yeah. You kind of have to go north, and then you'd have to swing around Alaska, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, and that is the Northwest Passage now, is around the north slope of Alaska and across, you know, above northern Canada. And that way is open now. But yes, when Mackenzie was on this river, which is now called the Mackenzie River, the Dene people that live up there in the upper basin, they know it as the Decho, which means big river. And it is absolutely enormous. It's, you know, some places you can't even see the other side, or it takes an hour or two to paddle across. There is this enormous river, and it leaves Great Slave Lake. And Mackenzie had heard from indigenous report trade, you know, with the various people that he traded with, there's this huge river, and it goes west into the setting sun. And he said, we have finally found it. We have found the last little step where we're going to get to the Pacific. And of course, for a little while, it does go west, and then it hits the Rockies and makes that turn. And that's how you end up in the Arctic.
Why did you decide to do this in a canoe?
Well, because he did it in a canoe. And it's the perfect speed to see the country. You know, you're going with the current. When we're paddling, sometimes we're going 5, 7, 10 miles an hour. Our plan was 30 miles a day. So 1,125 miles total from Great Slave Lake to the very last island, Garry Island, which is on the far end of the Delta. It took us 40 days to do it. Some days we did 50 miles. Some days we did zero when we were stuck with the wind. But I think it was the right way to experience it, because not only could I see what he saw, I could see it at the same timeline and the same pace and experience it in a similar way. And I think it would have been vastly different if I had flown into the one or two indigenous communities up there that have an airstrip and just like poked my head out and seen the trees and then gotten in a plane again. It was a very different experience dealing with the bugs and the lightning and the wind and the, where are we going to put our tent tonight? And, you know, it's not a park. There's no designated campsite. So sometimes when you were stuck in a swamp, there's just nowhere to stop. And you really start to appreciate wilderness in a different way.
Yeah, one of the points you make, and I have to say it really kind of set me back a little bit, because I'm guilty of this too, is romanticizing the wilderness.
Right.
And thinking of it as like this Hallmark postcard of the beauty of nature, and we're going to go out and we're animals too, and we're going to, you know, and then you realize, oh my God, I have no interest in living that way.
There's a reason that we developed all the technology that we did. And I blame Thoreau for, for convincing generations of Americans about the importance and the purity and the simplicity of nature. And let me tell you, a microwave and indoor plumbing is simpler. It is not simpler to wonder where you're going to sleep. It's not simpler to wonder where you're going to go to the bathroom. Do I have enough food? Is it going to spoil? Am I going to be struck by lightning because I'm the highest point in, you know, half a mile?
Are the bears going to come?
Are the bears going to come? Keeping away the mosquitoes, am I going to get an infection from, you know, standing in river water and having these bugs eat me all day? That's not simpler. And yes, I think we've really romanticized wilderness. in some ways, it's because in the lower 48, we have killed just about every animal that might eat us. And so we go to these national parks, and all we've done is taken the prettiest places and kind of set them aside. And we forget how much wilderness and boonies and really nothing but trees and rock and bugs there would be between those pretty places. If you had to, you know, if you had to walk from the Grand Canyon to Yosemite, there'd be a whole lot of nothing in between.
Yeah, and you'd be worried about snake bite, and you'd be worried about being eaten alive by bugs or having enough water.
Right, right. You know? And so, you know, that's why I did it in a canoe, to be able to get an appreciation for what was the physical and emotional toll that taking this kind of journey, you know, would have taken on Mackenzie and his voyagers and his indigenous partners, who I should say, Augina, who was also had the name the English chief. That was his Chipewyan trading partner. Augina had never been down this river either. So it was terra nova for all of them. You know, they ran out of food. They fought the bugs. It was very similar.
Do you think it might have been a little more difficult for you because you knew what you were leaving behind? They didn't have microwaves and indoor plumbing much to leave behind.
No, that's true. But at the same time, when they started their trip in June, they were already hungry because they had wintered over in the interior, you know, up at Fort Chipewyan, which is on what's now Lake Athabasca. So they were already starving. They were already out of flour and root vegetables and fresh meat and everything else. And that's how they started their trip. And I started fat and happy. And when I was done, I mean, I lost 25 pounds paddling for that 40 days, but I put on 35 when I got back. I mean, for a year, I just could do nothing but eat. And so, yeah, I knew what I was missing. But I mean, there are towns along the way. We went 10 days without seeing someone at times. But there's also villages where we could restock on very expensive fresh fruit or, you know, stale bagels and talk to people and get a shower even once in a while. I got 2 showers on the trip. So that was pretty good. That was a nice break.
What was the first thing you did when you got back to quote unquote civilization?
I wanted to sleep in a bed. I could go underwater. The river was cold, but, you know, we could get in it once in a while.
And pretty clean from what you wrote.
Yeah, and clean. I mean, there's some marine debris up there, but overall, you know, the indigenous nations up there have really focused on protecting what they have. And overall, they've done a very good job of that. No, I wanted a bed. I wanted to not sleep on rock, and I wanted my back to feel better. Because when I took a shower, all I wanted to do was take a shower again. I was more sad to be done with the shower than actually enjoying it.
When did that change? How long did it take for you to reacclimate into our civilization?
Actually, I think it's pretty easy. I think that it is easy to be a happy, overfed American. There's a reason that we developed this. So I was happy to have those stuff back. You know, as a military veteran, when I got back from Iraq, and in Iraq, you know, you're eating chow hall food, which is barely food. And I remember distinctly in the airport on the flight back, there were like 47 kinds of gummy bears for sale in the little kiosk at the airport, and how weird that was. So I guess because I've done this different experience and then back to finger quote normalcy, you know, going back and forth, this time I could look forward to it as opposed to having this odd experience.
Do you think the military background and being deployed and being out where you don't get showers and you don't eat real food for a while and you're in danger, it's a different kind of danger, but you're in a dangerous situation, did that prepare you in any way for this trip?
Yeah, absolutely. I call it misery training. It's learning that when you're cold and wet and tired and hungry, that those things will eventually end. And you just ignore being cold, wet, tired, and hungry, and then, you know, go on and do your business. Yeah, I think that is great training. And when I picked the people to go with me, overall, I had 2 military buddies that I knew had also received plenty of misery training and, you know, would be good at that. Another friend was from Wisconsin. He lives in Stevens Point. The fourth guy, as it turns out, had never been camping. I didn't know that until we were on the water. And by the end of it, he was a transformed man.
So what do you think for yourself? I mean, the history is fascinating, and the chapters go back and forth between, you know, the 1780s and 2016 when you did this. Putting aside the history for a moment, for yourself, what did you really get out of this? Has the takeaway changed? Does it change as time passes?
Yeah, I think, you know, from a like a big picture or a big idea, what struck me is that Mackenzie died thinking he was a failure, when in reality, he was just 200 years too early. He had this vision that maybe this was the Northwest Passage. And yeah, he wasn't wrong. Like, that is a shipping channel now. There's barges on there. Tuktoyaktuk, this little Inuvialuit village there on the coast. They're talking about putting in a deep water port to service freighters from China. And of course, Mackenzie was trying to get furs to China. So like some of these ideas never go away. So I've thought it's just interesting to think about how, you know, it's not just ideas that are important, but it's also timing that's important. So I guess that's kind of a big picture. For myself, I had never taken a trip like this. A little bit of it was proving to myself that I could do it, despite, like I said, all that misery training in the military. I had not done the Appalachian Trail. I had not spent this many days continuously in the wilderness. And I'm glad I did it and got to experience. I had read a lot about a lot of the challenges in indigenous communities in the North, poverty, desperation, suicide, alcoholism. It was all of that and more. It's actually astounding, you know, the reality of things up there. And I think that's part of the non-romance as well, is seeing the way people really live. And I think that's my strength as a writer, is going somewhere and bringing back a realistic portrayal and portrait. Here is this place that we don't pay that much attention to.
Or even think about it all.
Go there, and this is what it feels like to be a person in that place. And just look at it as realistically as possible, and then write that up the best I can.
If you were able to meet Alexander Mackenzie today, have a pint with him in a pub somewhere, what would you tell him?
I would commiserate with him. I spent like 2 years, 3 years doing nothing but thinking about this man, how he thought about things. I've read every single word of his that survives several times and parsed it out. And I can identify with some of the hardship and privation. I can identify with the fact that it took him years to write the book of this journey. He writes these great letters to his cousin about how he's trying to write, but it's way harder than he thought it would be. And he's having nothing but visions of the dead, and he thinks he's going crazy. And I think every writer can identify, you know, with that a little bit. And so I would just want to listen to him tell stories. I'm not sure that I would want to say much. I think I would want him to, you know, fill in the gaps, you know, in between some of those letters. Tell me more about the crew. We know very little about the voyagers that went with him. I want to hear stories about them. I'd want to hear stories about Augina, who is his Chipewyan partner. We know very little about him.
I wanted to know the stories of the women who went along.
Yes, absolutely. So in this party, Augina brought two wives and the voyagers brought two of their wives. And this was not some advanced egalitarian thing. It was pure practicality. The men did one job, women did other jobs. And there was, you know, as the Chipewyan said, like, you know, of course you need women. Women can carry twice as much of a load as any man. They can do twice as much work as any man. If the men are going to go out hunting, who's going to do the cooking and who's going to do all of these essential tasks? And we don't even know the names of these women that went. And so I tried to fill in as many gaps as I could, but there's only so much you can do in a nonfiction book.
Well, who knows? Maybe in some other universe, you guys will sit down over a pint and in front of a warm fire, and you'd be able to hear all of those stories. It's just that would be a wonderful conversation, I would think.
I agree.
Well, Brian Kastner, I want to thank you so much for coming in and talking with us about Disappointment River, Finding and Losing the Northwest Passage. What is your next adventure?
I'm not sure I'm allowed to say, but I do have a new book project, and it's also about the far north, and it's also history, but different. And I have to go on a hike, but it's a shorter hike. So I don't know if that's enough of a tease or too little of a tease.
No canoeing at this.
I'll be in the mountains with a backpack instead of in a boat on the water.
Okay. Well, when you're done with that one and you write it up, come back.
Absolutely. I would love to.
It's so great to meet you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Brian Kastner is the author of Disappointment River, Finding and Losing the Northwest Passage. The Marquette grad and Iraq War veteran also wrote The Long Walk and All the Ways We Kill and Die. There's more information about him and his work at WUWM.com.
We'll take one more break and then have our storytelling series, Ex-Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend returns with that right after this on Milwaukee's NPR.
I hope this whole train breaks down so I can take a walk around.
3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Ex-Fabula!
True personal story.
Ex-Fabula!
Ex Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
Ex Fabula Radio Time on Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bruce Winter with Ex Fabula co-founder Leah Delaney. We sit in the studio every weekend. Leah brings stories from past Ex Fabula events. And these next few weeks are really great because these are the people who were the audience favorites this year.
I thought you were about to say, these are the people in your neighborhood. But they are, actually. They're Milwaukeeans.
They are, yeah. You're right.
Season 9 was such a bang. We had so many great stories at our story slams and events. And you are exactly right. We are running down all of the audience favorites from this past season, airing them in hopes that we're going to ramp up a lot of excitement for our Season 9 All-Stars event on May 18th at Turner Hall Ballroom.
Yes, that is quite the show. I have sat through a couple of those, and these are the best storytellers of the year, telling stories that are longer and on a different topic.
Yeah, so usually they're 5 minutes. You know, they're all real, true personal stories, no notes and all that jazz. But this time they are 10 minutes long, or up to 10 minutes. So they're longer form stories. They're based on a completely different theme, which this year it's going to be connections. So it'll be a really good time.
Oh, sounds good. Well, so what do we got up first here?
Yeah. Let's do it. Let's roll with December. We had a story slam based on the theme of tradition. So ho, ho, ho. Let's listen to the audience favorite, Tony Anderson.
With the holidays upon us, I feel it's important to give you a very serious warning. Santa is dangerous. Now, don't get me wrong. I love Santa. And Santa's always been a very important part of our family's Christmas tradition. When my father was growing up, Santa visited them while they were away at Christmas Eve service, and so they arrived home to find presents. In my mom's family tradition, they woke up on Christmas morning and Santa had visited during the night. Well, since my parents couldn't agree on anything, they decided we were going to have Santa visit twice. And so we reaped the benefit of it. We came home from Christmas Eve service and we found our major presents underneath the Christmas tree. And then when we went to bed, despite the fact that Santa's busy delivering Christmas presents all over the world, he came back a second time and filled our stockings. It was a tradition that we carried on with our own children once I got married. But about 5 years ago, my views on Santa changed. I started teaching second grade, and I found out something very important. Santa is the most dangerous minefield I can walk when I'm talking with my 7 and 8 year old students. Now, most of them are fierce believers in Santa Claus. A few of them are starting to question things. And unfortunately, there are a few who do not believe and feel it's their job to enlighten the rest of their peers. The other problem is Santa can pop up anytime, any place. So one time, months after Christmas was over, I was reading a book about polar bears to my 7 and 8 year olds. And I was telling them that polar bears are predators, and they eat seals and small walruses and caribou. And one of my students said, "Well, Mr. Anderson, what's a caribou?" And I wasn't even thinking about it. And I said, "Well, it's a reindeer." And one horrified student said, "They eat Santa's reindeer?" I realized I had just stepped on a landmine. Fortunately, one of my really bright students spoke up and said, "No, they can't eat Santa's reindeer. They're too fast and they can fly." Another time, we were on Google Earth, and we're looking at the pyramids of Giza and the Great Wall of China. And I said, "Where do you guys want to go next?" And of course, the answer was the North Pole. "We want to see Santa's workshop." "I don't think we can do that, guys." "Well, why not?" "It's hidden by Christmas magic." And that seemed to suffice. So, 2 years ago, we had successfully navigated the Christmas season. Winter break was over, we came back, no Santa incidents. And I was relieved. We were coming back from lunchtime recess, and one of my really impulsive students came inside and he said, "Well, you know, there's no such thing as Santa Claus." And one of my believers said, "Yes, there is. Otherwise, who eats the Christmas cookies?" It was flawless logic. But the decrier was undeterred. And so he said, "No, there isn't." And I gave him my best teacher look. And I silently mouthed the words, "Stop right now." And then I got my students to gather up their supplies and we headed off to art class. And once we got there, I pulled my impulsive student aside and I let the rest of the students go into class. And once I realized it was safe, I turned to him and I said, "It's okay if you know that there's no such thing as Santa. But please, think about your classmates. Don't wreck this for them. Think about their parents." And his eyes got really wide and he looked at me. And he said, "Well, I didn't know." And I said, "What? But you said..." And he said, "Well, my cousin told me there was no such thing as Santa, but I didn't believe him." Santa truly is the most dangerous minefield in second grade.
And that was our favorite December dream killer, Tony Anderson, with his story about Santa's and tradition.
I'm telling you, Santa Claus is not only a minefield if you're a teacher in elementary school. And I have a niece and a nephew that both teach elementary school. So, but even in the family, if there's an older sibling, you know they're waiting for the day when they can kill your Santa Claus fantasy.
Right? Just waiting in the wings.
Oh, I'm telling you.
So we are featuring all of season 9 audience favorites because they're all going to be taking the stage on May 18th at the All Stars Showdown. But we do have a lot of other events that we showcase during our seasons with Xfabula, one of which is a really important one. We have a fellowship again this year, and we have a couple more fellowship events happening. So the first one is going to be on Sunday, May 6th at 12:30. It's on the theme of building bridges, and that's going to be at All Saints Catholic Church. And then fellows and facilitators, media and representation. That one's going to be all about, you know, who produces the media, who's behind the media, who is the media showcasing. Really important stuff. Who's being left out, more importantly.
How do I sign up for that?
Oh, you can go to xfabula.org, and, you know, all these events are free. Mm-hmm. So all of the fellowship events are free, and you just go on and you pre-register. Make sure you have your seat, because these do have a tendency to fill out. So Milwaukee, make sure you pre-register. I know we have a bad habit of walking up to a door and thinking we can get in.
Not always the case.
Mm-hmm. So let's roll it right into our second story of the day. This one is from our first time Story Slam, which was in February. And here is the audience favorite, Patricia McNamee Rosenberg.
This is about the first time that I had a date in 30 years. And my husband had died a year before this. And I went online and met a widower from Wisconsin. I'm from Illinois. Don't mind that. Anyway, so he was coming to see me at my new apartment in Illinois, and so I went over to the neighbor's house and I said, "This guy Denny is coming over to see me. Do you mind if you meet him and if I disappear, do something?" And she goes, "Oh yeah, no problem." So then I go shopping with my friend Peggy for my new date, and Peggy and I have been friends forever. We go and we're walking out of the mall. We get in my car. I look down at my cigarettes. I don't smoke. Peggy, we're in the wrong car. We jump out like we'd robbed a bank. We run down. We get in my car. We drive away. And we go to lunch. And then we're getting out at lunch. And I look back for my purse. And my purse is in the other car. And so now I'm hysterical. My whole life is in this car. It is a Coach bag. It has $250 of cash, all my IDs, and my cell phone. And I'm like, "Peggy, I have this date. What are we going to do?" So we go look for the car. We're driving around this parking lot. You know, there's no car. My purse isn't waving at us. I go, "Oh, no, we're going to have to call the police." So I call the police, and the dispatcher, she says to me, "You know, ma'am, we are not a lost and found." And I said, "Well, you know, it could have been kind of stolen, maybe." And she goes, "No, it wasn't stolen. You gave your purse away." I said, "Well, you know, maybe so, but you've got to get someone here to help me. I have no place to go. And she goes, okay. So she sends this 14-year-old policeman over, and he drives in his SUV, this plainclothes SUV. He rolls down the window. He wouldn't even get out. He goes, well, you know, ma'am. He goes, your car, your purse is missing. I go, well, it's actually not missing. The car it was in is missing. And I said, you know, and he goes, well, did it look like your car? I said, it could have been a Greyhound bus. We were talking a lot. I have no idea what we got in. And he goes, well, you know, I can't do anything for you. This wasn't stolen. I said, well, okay. He gave me a fake police report number. And he goes, you're going to take this, and then you can get everything replaced. He goes, I have a friend that lives in your neighborhood. He's a cop. He's not going to find your purse, but if we find your purse, I'll send him to your house. I said, terrific. Meanwhile, Peggy's in a bathroom. She's just dying. She's laughing so hard. So anyway, so I go home. I replace all my IDs and everything. Denny comes over, and I tell him this story, and he acts like this happens every day. No big deal. You know, we go out for margaritas, and at the second pitcher of margaritas, I get this phone call from the neighbors, and a policeman had showed up at the door, and the policeman says, you know, Birgit, my neighbor, calls, and she goes, Patty, you know, your purse is here, but you aren't here. You're with some guy in Wisconsin thinking something happened to me. So meanwhile, we go to the police station the next day, Denny and I. We go to pick up the purse, and I walk in, and they give me my purse, and it had been all organized, and there was this long list, like toilet paper long list, and it said things like Tylenol PM, old used Band-Aid, 3 M&Ms, 2 yellow, 1 green. It was so humiliating. Then they go, ma'am, you're not going to believe this, but your purse was found in the mayor's wife's car. And she just drove up to see her husband for lunch. He happened to work in the same place as the police, and hands it over. And I'm going, I didn't care where it was found. I go, tell me that they looked alike. Tell me the cars looked alike so Denny wouldn't run away. And he goes, yes, ma'am, the cars were identical. I go, hey, listen, could you keep this out of, like, the you know, papers or anything so nobody knows there was no crime? He goes, are you kidding, ma'am? We have your name on the bulletin board. Everybody's talking about you. We're going to start a blog about you. So Denny and I are still together, and he survived our first date.
And that was Patricia McNamee Rosenberg's story.
You know, I got to laugh. Because it is funny, but... I will never get into the wrong car because I don't think there's another car that looks like mine in Milwaukee or Wisconsin. You know, how many 15-year-old Honda Civics are out there with, you know, Brewer stickers on them? Not too many.
Is it still running, Bruce?
It is still running.
Oh, good.
It makes a little noise, but, you know, it gets me to work every day, and that's all that matters.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, good, good, good. Okay, so to wrap up today's All-Stars Preview Part 2, or DUR, we have a couple fellowship events coming up on May 6th and on May 9th. And then, of course, the Season 9 All-Stars season finale event, which the theme is Connection. That's going to be at Turner Hall Ballroom on May 18th. Get your tickets and all information story-related at xfabula.org.
And I know you recommend getting tickets ahead of time,
Yo.
Especially for the All-Stars event. Although Turner Hall holds a lot of people.
It does.
Make sure you have a ticket, right?
Yep, indeed.
All right. And if you want to hear these stories again or share them with others, you will find them at WUWM.com with pictures, too.
That's great news.
All right.
Thank you, Bruce.
We'll see you next week.
X-Fabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up another edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned now. All Things Considered is next. It's 4 o'clock.